You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 314, by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Physiology and Healing, Treatment, Therapy, and Hygiene. This is Lecture 6, the second lecture in the second part of this book. It's translated by Anna Mois and was given in Stuttgart on the 27th of October, 1922. If I were asked to organize the study of medicine for people who come to it directly and want to complete it in the course of some time, I would have to start, once the necessary knowledge of natural science has been gained, with a look at the different human functions. I would have to start anatomically and physiologically with the digestion of foods, from mixing with ptyalin and pepsin, to where foods are taken up into the blood, and then, having discussed the whole act of digestion in the narrower sense, move on to discussing the system of heart and lungs and everything connected with this. Then I would have to discuss everything connected with the human renal system. This would have to be considered in conjunction with the whole apparatus of nerves and senses, which does not at all relate to the renal system in the way suggested on the basis of today's accepted knowledge. And then come to the system of liver, bile, spleen. In following this cycle, we would gradually gain an overview of the way things are arranged in the human organism. We need this to develop what needs to be developed with the anthroposophical science of the spirit. On the basis, I'd say the illumination, of the results of empirical studies based on sensory experience, we would arrange them in the order I've just given, and then be able to move on to the therapeutic field. Now you can imagine that a few days only allow me to touch lightly on such a vast, comprehensive field. Our professional medical friends can only touch on things lightly in the whole of this week of medical talks, and it will therefore be necessary for me to say a great many things that are based on a way of treating the empirical data which is not customary today, but nevertheless arises of its own accord, I think, for anyone with the relevant present-day knowledge in physiology and also therapy. Some things will, of course, have to be put in a different way from the usual, but there is really nothing which cannot be made to be in some kind of harmony with today's empirical knowledge, based on sensory experience and taken as a whole. Everything I will be able to say will be aphoristic and basically merely state the ultimate aim. Our starting point would, however, be present-day empiricism based on sensory experience, and the road in between would really have to be produced by the efforts of our medical friends to the widest extent. For this road in between is extraordinarily long and absolutely necessary, simply because of the way things are today. The things we can present here today will essentially never be given full recognition unless this road is taken at least for the most important phenomena. Nor do I think that it is as difficult as it looks today. The effort must simply be made to bring the preliminary work, already available, sometimes extraordinarily good but not taken to its culmination the way it is today, into the context of the kind of general view I am attempting to indicate here. Yesterday I attempted to show you how we can approach the human being by broadening the usual way of gaining insight, as it were. If you take into account what I have just been saying, I may also be permitted to add the following. You may initially find it most objectionable when people say in the field of anthroposophy that one must differentiate the human being, as he presents himself in the physical world, into a system organized etherically, a system, please don't take umbrage at the words used, they merely serve to give us a terminology, a system organized astrally, and the one which characterizes the human being as an actual capital I system, so that he may develop that inner combination of soul qualities, inner soul which we do not see in animals, a combination which on the one hand appears because human beings are able to bring together their inner experiences in one capital I point, if I may call it that. From that point, their whole organic activity radiates out, in a sense, at least in the conscious state. And this is, on the other hand, reflected in the fact that during their development on Earth, human beings relate differently to sexual development, or the development of generations, than the animal organization does. Basically, the animal organization is such, there are, of course, always reasons for exceptional development, that it culminates in sexual maturity, and there is then a certain decay, which may not be very radical after the first period of sexual maturity, but there is a degree of organic decay. In human beings, on the other hand, physical development takes a certain upswing with sexual maturity. Externally, empirically, if we take all factors into account, there certainly is a difference between man and animal. You may say that it is really an abstract differentiation to speak of physical organization, etheric organization, astral organization, and I organization. Various people have raised that objection, especially from the philosophical side. One has the functions of the human organism and differentiates between them. Differentiation need not always have a factual basis, and believes one is dealing with an abstraction. That is not the case. We shall see what lies behind it in the course of these days. It is not just a longing to have things in schematic form which is behind it, for it is actually the case that when we speak of the human physical organization, this includes everything in the human organism which we are able to treat the way we do in our laboratory experiments and investigations. We cover all this when speaking of the human physical organization. Yet when we speak of the human etheric organization, we are not in a position to treat our way of thinking with regard to this etheric organization, which is incorporated into the physical organization, by stopping at the ideas and laws we discover in our laboratory experiments and observations. You may think as you will, initially, about the etheric organization, as it presents itself to supersensible investigation, but without the need to go somehow into the mechanistic or the vitalistic method, it is nevertheless evident, it would be subject to long discussions that would be part of the curriculum of which I spoke before, that the whole etheric organization, which you merely have to think of as a structure of functions, intervenes directly in everything that is fluid by nature in the human organization. We must therefore limit our physical way of thinking to everything which is solid in the human organization, essentially the solid state of aggregation, and only manage to cope with the human organization if we consider the fluid element in this organization not merely as fluid, as we have it in the inorganic, natural world outside, but as a fluid element that is fully enlivened, a living fluid. This is what we mean when we say that the human being has an ether body. And we need not go into hypotheses about life, but merely take what we mean, for instance, when we say the cell has life. We need not go further than that, irrespective of whether we are mechanists, idealists, or spiritualists. If we say the cell has life, as an out-and-out empiricist would also say, It is directly evident, with the method to which I am referring, that the element which is fluid by nature in the human being has life. This is the same as saying the human being has an ether body. We therefore have to see everything solid as embedded in fluid. This immediately gives us the contrast. Everything known by way of laws and ideas in the inorganic world is also applied to the solid parts of the human being, and not only the cells, as the smallest organisms found in the human being are believed to have life, but the totality of fluid elements in the human being is considered to be full of life. What is more, when we then come to the gaseous element in the human being, we find that everything of that nature is in a continuous exchange process. We will have to make it clear during these days that the exchange is not merely inorganic, nor is it mediated merely by the solid organs. The human organism has its own laws to govern the swirl of one into the other in the internal exchange of gases. We have inner laws relating to the solid element, reflected in the relationship between kidneys and heart. And we also have to accept a set of laws within this organism of gases or air, if I may call it that, which is not limited to the laws of solid physical organs. The laws which directly govern the organism of gases or air are, in anthroposophy, called the astral laws for the human being, the astral organization. They would not exist in human beings if these had not brought the aeriform organization into their solid and fluid organization. The astral organization does not intervene directly in the solid and fluid elements. It acts directly on the aeriform organization, and the latter does indirectly intervene in all kinds of ways in the solid and fluid organization. An organized astral organization thus exists within the airy human being, if I may call it such. This gives the airy organization a particular inner form, which is, of course, fluctuating. We simply move up through the states of aggregation and say to ourselves, looking at the solid human being, we need to assume nothing but a physical organization. Looking at the living, fluid, present throughout the solid physical organization, we have to assume something which is not limited to physical laws, for there we come to the etheric organism, which is a system complete in itself. In the same way, I call something, in quotes, astral organization, which does not intervene directly in the solid and fluid organism, but in the first place in the gaseous organization. I do not call it astral laws, but astral organism, because it is a system complete in itself. And we arrive at the I organization in the same way. It only intervenes directly in the differentiations between temperatures in the human organism, so that we may speak of a warmth organism, a human being of warmth. The I organization influences this human being directly. Being supersensible, it affects the differentiations in temperature, and above all also perceives them, lives in them. There, the I organization lives directly. It does so indirectly in the rest of the organism, in that the warmth influences all gaseous, fluid, and solid organization. Thus, you see, the human organism gradually becomes transparent. But everything I have said so far is such, in physical human beings on this earth, that it is also reflected in the physical human being. Looking at the organization, which we may, in a sense, call the most volatile, the I and warmth organization, we see that it has an indirect effect on the gas organization below, on the fluid organization and the solid organization. And the same holds true for the others. so that a solid organ system, initially capable of being established in external anatomy, reflects how this whole differentiated system influences the human organization as we know it from empirically established facts based on sensory experience. We can thus always refer to organ systems where only the solid physical system relates directly to its laws. The fluid does so indirectly, the gaseous even more indirectly, and the element of warmth as the most remote, but nevertheless relating through intermediaries. All the things I can now only refer to briefly, as in thoughts to aim at, can always be proved by means of extended empiricism, simply from the evidence of our senses. Time is short, and so I can only give you thoughts to aim at. If we take the human organization anatomically and physiologically, we can first of all consider the route taken by a food until it arrives at the intestinal walls, with all the complicated organs in that location, and is taken up into the lymph and blood channels. We are thus able to follow digestion, or nutrition, in the widest sense as far as uptake into the lymph and blood channels. Initially, we limit ourselves to this field, as we use a method of study generally applied in natural science today, though it is not entirely mechanistic, and manage reasonably well. A completely mechanistic view will not take us to our goal in this field either, for the laws we observe outside in the laboratory and characterize as inorganic laws in natural science do, after all, come into play in the digestive tract, that is, in the living organism. Life takes them in from the beginning, when ptyalin is added. Yet if we take account only of this, that external inorganic laws are, as it were, immersed in the life of the digestive tract, we can certainly manage for such a limited field, providing we stick to the things which can be observed within the human physical organization. But we must in that case be clear in our minds that there remains a residue of nutritional activity, digestive activity, that nutrition is not quite finished when the intestinal wall has been passed, and that we need to bring in other methods of study, as it were, for what follows. For the limited field will manage reasonably well if we first consider all conversions that take place by analogous methods, I'd say, like anything we get to know externally. There, however, we find something which is not easily acknowledged in modern science, but is nevertheless a truth which does certainly emerge from modern science. It would now be up to our medical friends to follow these things in a purely scientific way, and then to show that it simply emerges from the empirical facts based on sensory experience, that with foods taken in, ptyalin and pepsin added, and so on, the foods are prepared in such a way that they first lose every trace of their old existence in the outside world. You know, we take in foods from the mineral sphere. You may not like to use the term food for this, but we can understand one another when I want to use some term or other. We take in food from the mineral, vegetable, and animal worlds. The food we take in has gone through the mineral, animal, and vegetable organization. The food most similar to the human organization is the milk which the infant is given by his mother. He receives it as soon as it has left the human organization. The process which takes place in the human organization, when food is taken in, is that it is taken into the different glandular products, and essentially every trace of its origin is removed. We might even say that the element which makes it possible for us to let a purely natural, scientific, inorganic way of looking at things develop is something in which the human organization comes to our aid. Truly the chyme, or partly digested food, comes closest to external physical processes when it moves from the intestine into the lymph and blood channels. Human beings remove all the external properties of the chyme. They want to have it as similar as possible to inorganic organization. This is what they need. And they differ in this from the animal world. If you study the anatomy and physiology of animals, you will find that animals do not remove the constitution of material that passes into their body to the same degree. It is another matter with their products of elimination. The matter which passes into the body is more similar to its outer organization in animals than it is in humans. That is, more similar to the vegetable and animal nature. Continuing on into the bloodstream, according to its external constitution, in its inner laws. In human beings, the organization has advanced so far that human beings have made the chyme as inorganic as possible when it is allowed to pass the intestinal wall. There, the purely physical human being is really present in the region where the chyme passes from the intestine into the organization of heart and lung, if I may put it like that. This is the point where the approach we have been using here must, for the first time, turn into heresy for official natural science. For if you take the whole heart and lung tract, meaning the vascular system, if you take this whole tract, it is this which really changes food that has become wholly inorganic, if I may put it like that, into something that has life. The human organization cannot survive unless it gives itself the quality of life. In a wider sense, again, we need not go into the inner nature, but only the things we are always talking about in physiology. This is similar to the moment when we see the inorganic parts, say of protein, transformed into living protein, dead protein into living protein. Time being so short, we cannot, in view of the present situation in theoretical science, look at the way plants produce living protein. The fact is that in human beings, the process in which protein is given life comes when the chyme has been made as inorganic as possible. It happens through the system of heart and lungs, with all its appendages, of course. We are thus able to say, the system of heart and lungs exists to take the element which is physical system into the etheric organization. As human beings, it is not at the same level in animals, where it is much less clear-cut. We thus have a process of vitalization, catching the inorganic and taking it into the organic, into the vital sphere in a process taking place in the system of heart and lungs. This process could not happen in our physical world if certain conditions were not met in the human organization. You see, what I am now presenting to you as a transformation of chyme into an etheric organization, capturing and taking it into an etheric organization, cannot really happen, without further ado, within the laws that apply on earth. Angels can do it, but if they did, the spirits who did it would have to do it by flying around, having a mouth and esophagus and finally a system of stomach and intestines. Then that would cease to be and vanish into the etheric. So we would have digestive tracts floating about, borne by invisible etheric angelic spirits. The process I have been describing could not at all happen in the physical world without further ado. That would be impossible. It is only made possible in that the whole etheric system is forcibly taken down into the physical, made part of the physical, and this happens due to oxygen being taken up in respiration. So human beings are not angels now, but able to walk about on earth in physical form, walk about because their angelic nature is made physical, as they take in oxygen. This projects the whole, but in real terms, into the physical world, with the whole taking place as a physical system. Something that otherwise could only be wholly supersensible by nature performs this function as a system of heart and lungs. We thus come to see that just as carbon is the basis of animal, vegetable, and human organization, the human organization as well, except that it is not as solid as in the plant, in that it fixes the actual physical organization, so does oxygen relate to the etheric organization, insofar as it comes to expression in the physical realm. Here we have the two substances which essentially constitute protein in vitalistic form. But we have been using an approach that might equally well be applied to the protein cell, the cell itself. We merely extend the approach that might be used for the cell, and really should only just begin by taking not a microscopic view of the human being, but a macroscopic view as we look at the processes that are the link between digestive tract and the tract of heart and lungs, seeing how they are inwardly connected, how an etheric organization intervenes and is fixed physically by taking in oxygen. Now you see that this would only give us an entity that would exist in the physical world as having a digestive organization and an organization of heart and lungs. We have not reached the point where it is an entity with soul. This would, nevertheless, only be able to function in the supersensible sphere. And it is our task to show how into this whole, where the human being is a solid and fluid entity, comes the principle that makes the human being sentient, entering into his solid and fluid organization to make man a sentient entity with soul. We must be able to follow the ensouled before we can see the human being as an ensouled entity. By connecting the etheric organization and the physical body with oxygen, we now have the whole organization in which oxygen plays a role within the human being. The ensouled organization cannot develop unless there is a direct point of attack for the gaseous human being, which continues on into the physical organization. This is something still very remote from present-day thinking. Just think. I now have to draw your attention to this. Just as, thanks to the organization of lungs and heart, oxygen intervenes in the etheric, so the astral intervenes in the human organization via another organ system. This astral element also needs direct access to a physical organ system. If I draw a diagram of this physical organ system, the process I am referring to does not come from those physical organs, but from something connected with these physical organs in gaseous form, from the gaseous organization, therefore, which is connected with these solid organs. The development of astral and organic powers in the organism radiates out from this. The physical organ itself only develops on the way back thanks to its own radiation. First, the gaseous organization radiates out, making the human being into an ensouled organism, ensouling all organs, and then radiates back again by a roundabout route, so that a physical organ then also develops because it is now also involved in the human physical organization. This is the renal system, which is generally seen as an apparatus for elimination. It is secondarily an apparatus for eliminatory processes, as I will show today or tomorrow. I still have to speak about the relationship of renal eliminations to the higher kidney functions. Apart from being a physical organ for elimination, and of course playing a part in vitality, the kidney in its gaseous basis is the astral organism's organ for outward radiation, entering into the gaseous, and from there directly into the fluid and solid elements in the human organism. The renal system is thus something which, from its organic basis, fills us with powers of sentience, ensoulment, and so on, and thus fills us with an astral organism. Let me tell you that if you know the details concerning renal function, available in evidence-based empirical science, knowing it merely from books does, of course, always make it difficult to get a clear idea. And if you bring a certain instinctive inner vision to anything you have been, anything you have seen and observed in such functions, you will today have the possibility to discover the relationships everywhere between inner sentient experience and renal functions. It is merely that the eliminations are but secondary indications of the source from which they are eliminated. This source has come into existence through the renal functions. Insofar as the functions are the basis of the sentient system, this is also reflected in the different kind of elimination. If you need to broaden science there, I would recommend that you look for people who are a bit more sensitive and able to tell you certain things on examination. For instance, how elimination via the kidneys changes to a marked degree when they are thinking, depending on whether they are thinking in a room that is cold or one that is warm. Such purely empirical facts, which you must vary the way one does in modern science, will show you the outcome. With strict, systematic investigations, you will see the difference in eliminations via the kidneys when thinking in a cold or a warm room. You can also arrange the experiment so that you ask someone to think logically, and place a warm cloth on his head. Study the renal elimination, and then, as he thinks the same things, put cold compresses on his feet. You can thus do wholly evidence-based, strictly empirical studies, and they will give you the proof. Today we are not getting enough investigations of this kind, the reason being that people feel disinclined to go into such things. Nor do they go into allantois and amnion when studying cell division, investigating the embryo. These organs, which then drop away, are also studied, but to get to know the whole of human development, one would have to study the appendages much more thoroughly during embryonic development than the developments due to division of the germ cell. So once again, we need to establish everywhere the starting points for investigation of the right kind. Such investigation will show something of tremendous significance, for it alone shows the road we must follow to really understand the human being as a giant cell that is not visible but invisible. Today we do not describe the things we do describe of the human being by starting from the cell, for microscopy does not make us do this. The strange thing is that when one goes to the microscopic level with the methods to which I am referring, we get all the good results obtained in the school of Hertwig, for instance. You reach a certain point up to which you can study the cell under the microscope, but you cannot go beyond this and study the complex processes of life. Ordinary, empirical, evidence-based science comes to a halt here, but you can take it further in the science of the spirit. You now look at the whole human being, and the small point of the cell continues on for you for the whole human being. And you discover how the purely physical organization, I'd say, intervenes in everything connected with the structure of carbon, and the transition to the etheric organization is then connected with the structure of oxygen. Now, when you move on to the renal system, in series of exact experiments, you will in the same way get a connection with nitrogen, and you have now included carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen in your study. The trace of all the roles played by nitrogen as the body is astralized, can be easily followed in the metamorphoses of uric acid and urea. urea, though these must be studied in series of completely exact experiments. In everything you'll find in those exact series concerning the secondary secretion of uric acid and urea, you will get confirmation that this points to quite specific things that show how the human being is fully astralized in a process coming from the renal system. This will also be evident from other things that play a role in renal function, including pathological states, to which I'll briefly refer tomorrow, when blood cells of one kind or another are found in the urine. The renal system simply lets the astral organization radiate into the human organism. We must not consider the physical organization, but the gaseous organization connected with it, and nitrogen again plays its role, so that the whole would otherwise be supersensible, just as we would be etheric if oxygen did not come into it. Nitrogen ensures that human beings can walk on this earth, can be earthly human beings. Nitrogen is the third element to connect with it. One feels the need all the time, on the principles of spiritual science, to work toward a continuation of the methods used in anatomy and physiology. This is not because of some fantasy, as you can see from the things arrived at in the first place. The strict demand is, approach the renal system, investigate urea and uric acid secretions, and so on, as exactly as possible, more exactly than is done anywhere today, under different astral conditions, investigate the whole systematically, and step by step you'll find that what is said in this way is proved. And it is only with this that you are able to look into the constitution of the human organism. We are thus able to say that through the renal system everything human beings receive with their food intake is captured in the astral organism. We only need now to get it into the eye organization. Everything is initially taken into this through the liver and gallbladder system. The principle found in the warmth structure and in everything by way of warmth structure in the liver and gallbladder system radiates out in such a way that the human being is filled with eye organization, an organization which is altogether bound to the temperature differentiations in the whole of the organism. You truly can organize your methods of experimentation as accurately as possible in line with what I am now saying. For in the first place, look at lower animals, where there is no suggestion of an eye organization from the point of view of the soul. You do not find a developed liver, nor bile acid in the process. Phylogenetically, these things only develop in the order of animals when things go in the direction of an eye organization. The development of liver and gallbladder is entirely parallel to the level of eye organization which an entity gains. You can, of course, also set up physiological series of investigation, though these need to cover also the different stages in life. You will then see how such eye organization, as there is in the human being, is connected with liver function. You merely have to study pathological states, like certain childhood diseases that are fatal, and you will discover that certain soul organizations, not in the direction of sentience but in the direction of the eye, are connected with the secretion of bile. You'll find that there an enormously fruitful series of experimental methods opens up. Some of them it will be possible to put together from what evidence-based empirical science has to offer. They merely need to be developed. You'll see that in the same way as the physical organization is connected with carbon, the etheric organization with oxygen, the astral organization with nitrogen, the eye organization is connected with hydrogen. You will be able to incorporate all temperature differentiations, I can only refer to this briefly, in the particular function that hydrogen has in the organism, of course always in conjunction with other substances. Moving up from the sensible to the supersensible, but grasping this supersensible by considering its physical representatives, we reach the point where we can take the whole human being as a highly complex cell, as it were, a cell which is ensouled and filled with the Spirit. You see, here again, it is really only a matter of taking the trouble and not simply leaving our marvelous natural scientific findings at a particular point, but to take them up, follow them, and take them further. The way I see things, and with my experience of life, I am convinced that if you were to sit down today and simply go through the empirical material available in conventional science, putting things nearest to hand together with those most remote, considering how things are connected, you will come across every single thing I have been saying here. I am absolutely convinced that all the occultists you study, and altogether people of the kind one calls occultists today, will not help you. You will have much more help with what is meant here if you really follow the empirical facts presented in conventional natural science. Natural science itself makes you acknowledge things which of course can only be seen supersensibly, but from which you get the idea that we must follow the empirical facts in the one direction or the other. You'll discover the methods for yourselves. The facts will make you develop them. There is no point in complaining that you make someone prejudiced with these regulative principles, or that they are suggestive. Things arise from the subject matter itself. But the facts which arise are complex. To pursue the matter further, you'll need the following. Everything you get to perceive of the human being in this way then needs to be investigated in its relationship to the outside world. I'd now ask you to follow me in a brief train of thought. It is meant to be more an example, but will put you in the way of how to proceed there. Let us take an annual plant rising from the ground in spring and going through its annual cycle. Relate the phenomena you observe in the annual with other things you are able to observe. Above all, something like the way farmers dig trenches at a certain depth to store their potatoes through the winter, putting the potatoes into them so that one will have them for the next year. They will not be fit for consumption if stored in the ordinary kind of open cellar. You know that all series of experiments in this area let you experience the outcome of interaction between exposure to the sun on the one hand and the soil on the other, taken down to a deeper level in the winter months to follow. Temperature conditions and the powers of light are at play in the soil. The dynamics are below the Earth's surface in winter, so that we really have the after effects of summer down there in winter. Summer is above ground all around us. In winter, the potential powers summer can have come into play underground. The consequence is, I have to take great leaps, of course, but empirical observation will easily verify this, that the plant in growing from the soil in its year is at first really growing with the powers which the sun has given to the earth the year before, if not earlier, for the plant takes its dynamics from the soil. These dynamics taken from the soil can be traced as far as the ovary, as far as seed development. We therefore only have a genuine botany that is in accord with the whole physiology if we take account not only of the dynamics of warmth and light and of light conditions in the year when the plant is growing, but starting from the root, base ourselves on the dynamics of light and warmth at least in the year before. We can trace this as far as the ovary, so that we have something in the ovary which happened the year before, still active from the year before. If, on the other hand, you study the foliage, and even more the sepals and petals, you will in the leaves find a compromise, I'd say, between the dynamics of the year before and the dynamics of the current year. The leaves have in them the element pushing up from the soil and the influences of the environment. In the petals, the current year finally shows itself in its purest form. The colors and so on in the petals are not something old. They are of this year. You cannot study an annual plant by only considering the current situation. Just follow the consecutive structural situation over 2 years, now in time, to see this. But the things that the sun tells the earth, as it were, persist for much longer. Run series of experiments on how good the plants still taste to creatures such as the grubs of maybugs, and you'll see that you need to relate the things which at first you consider to be of this year in the plants with sun conditions from the year before. You know how long those grubs need before they show themselves, enjoying the plant once they have gone through their larval stage. All these things need to be exactly investigated. Only guidelines can come from the spiritual world. You then find that the structures of substances found in the petals and leaves, for instance, are greatly different from the structures of substances found in the root, or even all the way to the seed. The difference is enormous. And this makes the difference if you make a tea, let us say, from the organs of the flower, or rather the leaves, or choose to make a decoction of roots or seed. You will find that this difference underlies the other differences. The difference between the action of a tea made from petals and leaves, or of a decoction from the roots or seed. This is how you relate the human being in his organization to the environment, and are able to verify everything you find there in purely physical, sense-perceptible terms. You will discover, however, that irregularities in translating the chyme into the etheric organization, for instance, as it takes place through the system of heart and lungs, are influenced by foliage. Everything connected with the digestive tract is greatly influenced by what we get when we make a tea of petals. A decoction of root and seed influences the activity which follows into the vascular system and as far as the nervous system. This gives you the rational connection between the functions of the human organism and the sphere where our armamentarium may be built up. In the afternoon, I'll go on to show you the inner connection between the different structures of the plant we are able to identify and the human neurosensory organization and digestive tract organization. The end of Lecture 6.